Welcome, everybody, to our third installment in our series of the interface of medicine and the halacha. As you may recall, in our first segment, we talked about medical history. In our second segment, we had the opportunity to talk about organ donation, both living organ donation and cadaveric organ donation. And actually, I asked if any of you wished to ask any questions about that organ donor conference for those of you who attended. Feel free to do so, and if you don't want to do so now, you can also get my email afterwards. I'd be happy to address any of the issues that came up at the conference this past Sunday. And for this week, we're going to be talking about another very current and very exciting topic, and that is the topic of genetics, the Human Genome Project. Will it be Elon or Ilana? Gender selection in the Human Genome Project in Halacha. Now, I know that Rabbi Kelman sent out the handouts to everybody, so I trust everybody has the handouts in front of them for tonight's lecture. In order for us to get an idea of the impact of genetics on the entire family, what I'd like to do this evening is to actually discuss with you a typical Jewish family, perhaps a fictional family, but the cases are not fictional cases, they're all real cases. And we will go through the life of this family to see how genetics impacts on this family and halachic issues that come up during the course of their lifetimes as they encounter genetics in real life. So we begin our discussion this evening with a young couple whose names are Jacob and Rachel. Jacob and Rachel are engaged to be married, and their parents approach them, their respective parents, and say, bad idea, it might not be a bad idea for you to get genetic testing before you get married. Now, this young couple has no idea, they're quite naive, never been exposed before to the field of genetics. And actually, this is the first time in their lives that they're even hearing this term, genetic testing. And their very first encounter in their lives of genetic testing. So if you look on your handout, you'll see under the first page, under the title, Testing to Identify Adult Carrier Status. It is now possible to identify, with the Human Genome Project, a number of genes that have been associated with the Jewish community. Some are associated more specifically with the Jewish community, some less so. And here you have a partial list, it's not a complete list, of some of the genes which can be tested for in an adult to determine carrier status. Now, what does carrier status mean? I apologize, this lecture is not going to be a lecture on medical genetics. That obviously would take us somewhat afield. But what that means is that when one individual carries this gene, there is no particular problem to that individual whatsoever. No medical issues, that person could live their entire lives as a healthy individual for a carrier of a recessive gene. However, if they marry another individual who carries that recessive gene, there's a possibility that their offspring will each receive that recessive gene from both of their respective parents, and there's a 1 in 4 chance that that individual would have that particular disease. So one of the classic diseases which we're going to be talking about this evening actually is the Tay-Sachs disease, which is number one on the list. Tay-Sachs disease is a recessive gene, and if both parents carry that recessive gene, there's a 1 in 4 chance that their offspring will develop that disease. And as we read through this list, some of these diseases may be familiar to you, some may not. Familial dysautonomia, Canavan's disease, Niemann-Pick disease, Gaucher disease, Fanconi's anemia, etc., etc. So now, this is the average list of genetic diseases that one could test for. In a number of different ways. Now, one could go to a local medical center. I'm sure the University of Toronto could test you for these, or York University might be able to test you for these, or your average medical center. But there is also an organization called Dor Yesharim, which we'll talk about, which some of you may or may not be familiar with. But this young couple, their first question is, why should I even bother testing for this? we don't know of any specific family members in our family that have had this disease. Maybe this is something you shouldn't even bother doing. Maybe it's not worth it. Maybe it's not worth the money. Maybe it's not worth the effort. Furthermore, we have belief in God, and God's going to protect us. Why should we? We'll pray. We'll have faith that nothing's going to happen. Maybe let's not bother testing. So in answer to this question, we have a response in your handout by Rav Moshe Feinstein of Blessed Memory. And the question that was posed to him, and I'll read from the handout, some excerpts from the handout. In Yesh Livdok L'Makalat Tesex, Kodim HaNasuim, should one indeed test for Tesex disease prior to marriage? So he writes, Ianti Bazeh, V'zehu Anirol Aniyaz Daiti, Ki'afshu Miut Kakan Yiladim Noladim Ke'elu. So Rav Moshe writes that I delved into this, and when Rav Moshe writes he delved into it, there's no question that he educated himself about all the medical aspects of this condition. And he states that even though a minority of children will develop this disease, the Shaykh Lomer al-Zeh Tamim Tiyeh Mashom al-Kecha, and one could argue, maybe one could say I should walk simply in the ways of God and God will protect me. However, skipping to the end of that line, Yikol Makom, since now it is quite simple to test, it is as if one doesn't avail themselves of this easily accessible testing, one is closing your eyes, turning a blind eye to the obvious, to the easily determinable, to something which you could theoretically prevent. And he writes, this is an important aspect, in Yikavim Shim Chas Tashom Yirod Dover Kazeh Lahore Hayelad Sar Gadol Me'od. Since if this does happen, and one indeed does have a child who is afflicted with a disease, Tay-Sex, the stress and anguish will be extraordinary, obviously, for the child, for whom there is close to 100% fatality very early on in life, but also to the family as well. L'chein tov l'farsem hadavar, in the last line, therefore it is appropriate to publicize this. Ayide itonim, by newspapers, so that the entire world should know that this test exists and one could avail themselves of this test. So this young couple, Jacob and Rachel, decide that they want a test. They think it is a good idea. So they go to this organization called Dor Yesharim. The way Dor Yesharim works, it's very interesting. You may recall, and I believe we had an opportunity to talk a little bit about smallpox in our first talk. And when we talked about, maybe we addressed this specific issue or not, but in this disease, smallpox, many centuries ago, there was a man who had written a treatise about the treatment for smallpox, and he had lost two children to the disease smallpox. And he begged the rabbis of his time, please approve the current therapy, which may have halachic issues, so as to prevent other people from developing this very serious condition. So we have a similar figure in our lifetimes. We have a man named Rabbi Eckstein, and this man, Rabbi Eckstein, tragically lost a total of 4 children to the disease Tay-Sachs, and this was a number of decades ago. And he thought to himself, what could I possibly do to prevent other people from suffering the extraordinary loss that I had? He, Baruch Hashem, went on to have many other healthy children. So he founded this organization called Dor Yesharim. This organization is an organization which tests people prior to marriage. Its objective is to test to determine if people are carriers for the disease, and if the boy and the girl, or the man and the woman are in fact carriers, they would notify them and strongly discourage them. Now, what is interesting about Dor Yesharim is a unique element. Dor Yesharim is not open testing; it's closed testing, which means that in contradistinction to average, that in Rabbi Kelman writes, that would only work in the Shidduch world. And he happens to be in the Shidduch world. He is a Haredi fellow functioning in Williamsburg in New York. And what they do is they test an individual. They don't give you the results. They simply give you a number, and your results are held in their bank. And if you find a potential spouse, a potential partner, that partner also gets tested, and then you simply submit both numbers to Dor Yeshorim. They will then match one number against the other number and see if both are carriers for the particular gene. Now, why don't they do open testing? So as Rabbi Selman points out, the reason they don't, and this is an arguable point which we're not going to discuss at length today, the reason they don't is to preclude a potential stigma associated with the testing. Now, there is a concern, perhaps more so in the right-wing world than in the quote-unquote modern Orthodox world, that being a carrier for a disease such as Tay-Sachs disease or some of these other genetic diseases may negatively impact the possibility to get a shidduch. Now, one could obviously counter and say that an individual has no problem medically whatsoever, zero, and that the educated individual be fully aware that one does not have any medical problem and shouldn't impact a shidduch in any way, shape, or form. But again, we could discuss this at length if other people want to address this issue, perhaps in the question and answer. So Rabbi Kelman asks about the BRCA1 gene. We will, Mir Hashem, get to the BRCA1 gene as well, both for men and women. The impacts on both men and women. But in any case, this couple decides to test for this gene, and lo and behold, they are found out to both be carriers for the Tay-Sachs gene. Dor Yeshorim receives their two numbers and notifies them, strongly, strongly discourages them from getting married. But they say, you know, we've fallen in love, we realize there's a risk involved here, and we'd like to go ahead with the marriage. Starting the shidduch, which is an arguable point. Many people in the quote-unquote modern Orthodox world are testing after they're engaged. At that point, if you're found out to both be carriers, to break off an engagement is a much more complex issue, much more emotionally wrenching. So they find out that they're both carriers and they decide to get married anyway. They do get married. And about a year later, Rachel becomes pregnant. And she now remembers this conversation that she had about a year and a half earlier with Rabbi Eckstein in Rabbi Eckstein's office, who strongly counseled them against getting married. She now recalls that there is a 1 in 4 chance that the child that she is carrying could indeed be afflicted with Tay-Sachs. What now does Rachel do? What are her halachic options? Now, there are ways to determine whether her fetus is afflicted with a genetic. And there are two forms of testing that are done as prenatal testing. Now, for those women who are participating or familiar with the prenatal testing, there obviously is blood testing that is done. There are ultrasounds that are routinely done in pregnancy. An ultrasound will not determine in any way, shape, or form whether a child is afflicted with a genetic disease. The only way to determine whether a child is afflicted with a genetic disease is to obtain genetic material from the fetus. The only way to obtain genetic material from the fetus now, and there are some new possibilities on the horizon, but the conventional procedures include two procedures. One is called amniocentesis, and the other is called chorionic villus sampling. Both of those are methods that are used to obtain fluid. Now, you'll see in your handouts in the bottom right-hand corner, this is actually from a Hebrew periodical. I thought it would be interesting to see the Hebrew terms over here. It shows, actually, what you're looking at is an illustration of the uterus on the bottom, the rechem, and there's an ultrasound. The sorek is the ultrasound machine, which is looking at the fetus through the ultrasound, and the machat is the needle, which is a very long, thin needle, which is inserted to obtain genetic material from around the fetus. It could be obtained either from the amniotic fluid or from the chorion. That's not so much our specific issue. But the question is, this young couple, who is now extremely concerned that their fetus might be afflicted with Tay-Sachs, might have both recessive genes from the husband and the wife, are they permitted to undergo amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling? And the more important question, if they indeed undergo this procedure and it is determined that they are affected, Will they be able to do something about it? Will they be able to subsequently abort the child? Will they be able to abort at all under any circumstances? If they are able to abort, what stage of pregnancy, what gestational age, until what gestational age could they be able to abort? These are the very serious questions that this young couple is dealing with at a young age. So here again, we turn to the responsum of Rav Moshe. In the bottom source on this first page of your handout, where he writes, "Ima mutter lizdok ubar, imhu chole, shelo yuchol lichyos." Can one perform a test to determine that a fetus has a particular medical condition? Here, the medical condition is he's referring to as Tay-Sachs disease. Just a brief tangent. Tay-Sachs disease, the way the natural progression of the disease, the child is born appears healthy and behaves normally for a few years, and then starts to develop neurological decline, which happens precipitously, till very tragically the child very often doesn't survive. Actually, it's close to 100%, if not 100% mortality. By removing fluid around the womb of the inside the womb of the woman, i.e., by performing amniocentesis. Line which begins bidvar. Bidvar ma'ase harofim himtziu sheicholim lotzi mehaubar shemei ha'isha kishimu beres kriyud beis shavuos. One can perform a procedure. At a certain gestational period during pregnancy, by a needle to to remove fluid. Is that, and I'll just synopsize here, is that permitted or is that not permitted according to Jewish law? So a big factor here for Moshe Feinstein is whether one is allowed to take action with the results of this test. So the results of the test may determine that indeed the child is afflicted with Tay-Sachs disease. If that is determined with relative certainty, with medical certainty, could one perform an abortion or not perform an abortion? So the ability to perform the test is obviously predicated upon the permissibility of action based on the result. So if you look, I believe it's six lines from the bottom of this page, in the sentence beginning, Ume'achar she'ika issa retzicha al ubar, since in the eyes and in the opinion of Moshe Feinstein, an abortion is considered akin to homicide. Pashut she'af neida b'barur shehu vlad kazeh sheyichyeh rak zman katzar, etc. V'lo yashum das v'yitzarchu litroach harbe imo yoser, you still cannot perform an abortion. So Moshe Feinstein says, even if you know 100% that the child has Tay-Sachs disease, and you know that the child will suffer a tragic death at a very young age, there's absolutely no way, according to Moshe Feinstein, that one could perform an abortion on his child. Consequently, if one cannot take action with the results of the amniocentesis or the chorionic villus sampling, there is no reason in the eyes of Moshe to perform the test whatsoever. Because not only can't you act on the results, the test itself could potentially be harmful to the fetus, if it's a healthy fetus. There is a small percentage of spontaneous miscarriage associated with amniocentesis. So you may have a healthy child perform the amniocentesis, and you might spontaneously miscarry a child which was otherwise healthy. So that's an additional factor, according to Moshe Feinstein, why amniocentesis should not be performed. And again, even if the amniocentesis were positive, no action can be taken according to emotion. We now turn the page. We find another position, which is a polar extreme position of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now, our discussion this evening is not a discussion about abortion. Obviously, we could spend a lengthy time about the issue of abortion in halacha, but suffice it to say that, interestingly, there is no consensus within the rabbinic literature about whether abortion is permitted and under which circumstances abortion is permitted. the very nature of the prohibition of abortion is a matter of intense rabbinic debate. There are at least five or six positions about the nature of the prohibition of abortion. It is by no means universally agreed upon what the prohibition of abortion is. So we're reading the polar extreme of the position of Rav Moshe Feinstein, and that is the position of the Tzitzel Yezer. The Tzitzel Yezer, as we may have mentioned in our previous lectures, Tzitzel Yezer just passed away a number of months ago. Tzitzel Yezer was one of the greatest rabbinic authorities of our generation. He was the head of the Beis Din in Yerushalayim. He wrote 24 volumes of responsa called the Tzitzel Yezer. He wrote extensively in the field of medicine and halacha in his Piskei Tshuva, or pioneering decisions in this field, and remain constantly cited in many discussions in medical halacha. So here he writes in a classic responsum on our second page, Ba'asher al-Kain kasher gilisi da'asi me'rosh. I have revealed my position on this particular matter regarding the propriety of performing an abortion on a child who is determined to have Tay-Sachs disease. Nira l'fi ani yazdaiti, it appears according to my opinion, the yesh lehatir l'tigal nidonenu, one could indeed permit an abortion in this particular case if the child is found to have Tay-Sachs. The Sadeh of Sokas Hirayon Miyad, in Hivoda Hamikhan Habarur Vahavadai, Shachain Yulad Yulod Kazeh, that indeed the child is afflicted with Tay-Sachs. And here is the key phrase, which is quite an extraordinary statement. Afilu ad Shiv'a Chodoshim Lehiryona, until 7 months of gestation. According to the opinion of the Tzitzel Yezer, the most lenient opinion in all of rabbinic literature, it is not only permitted to perform an abortion if the child is afflicted with Tay-Sachs disease, it is permitted to perform the abortion until the 7th month of gestation. Quite an extraordinary psak. Now, obviously, according to the Tzitzel Yezer, if one is permitted to perform an abortion if the child is determined to have Tay-Sachs, it is obviously permitted for the child, for the couple, for Rachel and Jacob, to undergo amniocentesis in order to determine whether the child is afflicted with Tay-Sachs disease. So that's this particular couple goes to their rabbi for psak. Their rabbi happens to be a student of the Tzitzel Yezer, and he paskens for them that it is indeed permitted for them to undergo the amniocentesis. So with great trepidation, Jacob and Rachel go to their gynecologist who performs the amniocentesis. They have to wait a few days for the results. And Baruch Hashem, it is found out that the child is not afflicted with Tay-Sachs disease, and they give birth to a healthy baby boy. A year now passes, or perhaps a little less time passes, and Mazel Tov. And now they're considering having another child. But Rachel thinks to herself, and she says, I remember what an extraordinary stress it was for me to undergo this first pregnancy. The fear, the constant fear that this child might have Tay-Sachs disease. If Rachmana Litzlan, the child has Tay-Sachs disease, would it be permitted for me to undergo the abortion, not undergo the abortion, even if the rabbis would have permitted for me to have an abortion? You know, she says to herself, I'd rather not have a child at all. I'd rather not undergo this pregnancy. I don't want to have any more children. First of all, is that an appropriate thing for her to say? Second of all, are there other options now in the 21st century which perhaps this young couple, Jacob and Rachel, could avail themselves of, which could perhaps obviate some of the halakhic concerns of performing an amniocentesis and also performing the subsequent abortion? So the answer to that is yes. So Rabbi Kalman writes in vitro fertilization, but it's more than that. It's one step beyond in vitro fertilization. The answer is yes, they could avail themselves of in vitro fertilization. But not only do they require in vitro fertilization, there is another secondary step, which is relatively new, And that test or procedure is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD for short. Now I'm just going to spend a moment or two discussing this technology. Tonight we're going to discuss maybe one or two ramifications of this technology. But this technology is truly extraordinary. The ramifications of this technology we are only beginning to see. We are going to be dealing with the ramifications for many decades. Just to give you an idea of the complexity, I sat on a committee in Washington, D.C., to advise for policy for the government on issues of genetics. We spent 6 months on the ramifications of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and we didn't feel that we had accomplished as much as we wanted to accomplish. In short, the technology is as follows. If you look on your handout, you'll see an illustration in the upper right-hand corner of that second page. What you are looking at is an embryo in the 8-cell stage. Now, usually the embryo, once fertilization occurs, the embryo begins to double. So first there's 1 cell, then 2 cells, 4 cells. At the 8-cell stage, just after a few days of after fertilization, the scientists can remove 1 cell from that 8-cell. And what you're looking at is the removal of that 1 cell. On the left hand is a pipette extracting one of those 8 cells from that embryo. The scientists can take that 1 cell, take it to the laboratory, and test it for everything that is testable at the time in the field of genetics. So now we've completed the Human Genome Project. There's still many, many genes which elude identification and will be identified, God willing, over the next few decades. But there are quite a few genes that we can test for. So one of the genes we can test for is Tay-Sachs disease. We could also test for a whole host of other diseases. And just to share with you, and I have here some references to it in the handout, one of the fascinating applications of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis and its marriage with the stem cell research is the following. And I'll just go off on this tangent just to share with you how far medicine has come. There was a case about 10 years ago where a woman had a child who suffered from a disease called, I believe it was either some leukemia or it was Fanconi's anemia, and the child needed a bone marrow transplant. So they searched the world, the entire world, and could not find a bone marrow donor for this particular individual. So what they decided to do is they decided to conceive a child in the natural fashion, in the hopes that that child would be an exact bone marrow donor match for their existing child. And similar to the Tay-Sachs genetics, there's a 1 in 4 chance that that child would be a so-called HLA match, or a proper donor for that existing child. As divine providence would have it, that child turned out to be an exact match and served as an organ donor. But with the technology of PGD, one does not need to leave it to chance. They had only a 1 in 4 chance that their child would be a donor for their other existing child. There have been a number of cases, probably less than 5 in the past few years. One such case occurred in London just about a year or two ago, of a family who had a son with Fanconi's anemia. What they did is they took his sperm and her eggs, fertilized them in the laboratory, created a number of embryos. Every single embryo. So Shalom asks, isn't this unethical? They're taking huge risks, so we'll discuss that as well. So they tested every embryo until they found an embryo which was an exact genetic match to their existing child. They then implanted that embryo into the woman's womb. In the delivery room, and we didn't talk about this, and Mr. Shem, maybe we'll talk a little bit about it next week, they harvested just a handful of stem cells from the umbilical cord, so-called umbilical cord stem cells. Those handful of stem cells were used to regenerate an entire bone marrow system in that child suffering from Fanconi's anemia, and completely treated and cured that child. An absolutely extraordinary application of technology. And this is just one small application of PGD. These children who have been created to save their siblings have been labeled in the ethical literature a savior sibling. And there is an ethical debate about the propriety of creating a child for the sole purpose of being a donor, a bone marrow donor, a stem cell donor to their existing child. Not our discussion tonight, and I'll answer Ilana's question in a second, but some countries forbid it. Some countries forbid the production of the use of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to produce a savior sibling. Others allow it. The United States is more permissive. So Ilana asks, did they abort the fetus? And this is a very important question, just to clarify. The child was born, and the child was, the umbilical cord blood harvesting does not impact on the health of the child at all. And in point of fact, the blood is sampled from every umbilical cord of every child that's born, almost throughout the world. So there was no need to abort the fetus, and they didn't abort the fetus. This was in the delivery room, and the child was delivered and was a healthy child. The question, somewhat a halakhic question, which we may get to next week if we discuss stem cells, which I think we'll discuss at least partially, is what do you do with the remaining embryos? What's the status of the resultant embryos that didn't test as a match for that child? Are these embryos destroyed? Can they be destroyed? Do these embryos have a status as human life? Do they not have a status as human life? That is an issue which we'll discuss in your session next time. But these are some of the uses of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So this couple wanted to know if perhaps, as Jacob and Rachel, if they maybe they could undergo pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Why not? After all, they could determine with certainty, in good hands, that the embryos that they would implant would not have Tay Sachs disease. So the halakhic issues that relate to whether it's permissible for them to undergo pre-implantation genetic diagnosis relate to another major field, which is not in our roster for this brief series, but is nonetheless a very, very extensive and important topic, and that's the general issue of treatment of infertility in Jewish law and the use of forms of assisted reproduction. So normally, you know, conception takes place naturally, but there are many couples that suffer from infertility, and there are ways of achieving conception in what are called the somewhat unnatural forms. So one can perform artificial insemination by harvesting the male seed and inserting it directly into the woman's reproductive tract. One could harvest both the reproductive seed of the man and the woman and fertilize it in the laboratory and then insert that egg into the woman in a procedure called in vitro fertilization. And there are medical reasons for performing this kind of procedure. The general halakhic impediment for this procedure, interestingly enough, is the acquisition of the male reproductive seed. How that seed is acquired, how it is harvested, under what conditions, and we're not going to get into detail, but suffice it to say that the rabbis discussed this very extensively, very graphically, in a very forthright fashion, how the sperm is to be procured. And there's a hierarchy in terms of how it's to be procured. And the reason is that there is a major halakhic concern about the wasting of the male reproductive seed or the destruction of the male reproductive seed. And there's a whole host of these issues. So these issues are discussed when a couple suffers from infertility, and many, many rabbis allow different forms of assisted reproduction for a child that suffers from for a family that suffers from infertility. And the justification has been that they would be able to fulfill the mitzvah of be fruitful and multiply thereby. So one can circumvent these concerns from a halakhic perspective. However, Jacob and Rachel do not suffer from infertility. They're completely capable of conceiving a child naturally. The only reason they would be employing this technology would be to select a child that wasn't afflicted with a disease. Is that something which is halakhically permitted or not permitted? So the Poskim, and here's where the lines are going to be pushed for the coming generations. The Poskim are pretty clear that one would indeed be permitted to avail themselves of this technology to prevent the birth of a child afflicted with severe disease. So, for example, there is a PGD lab, a pre-implantation genetic diagnosis lab, that has just opened in Shaarei Tzedek over the last year or two, with the approbation of Ravel Yashiv, and that the permission to perform pre-implantation genetic diagnosis falls under the rubric of virapo yirape, of healing or preventing preventative disease, preventing the development of a very severe disease for the birth of a child. So this couple went to their Rav for Psak, and it was found that indeed they were of Paschim, that it would be permitted for them to undergo pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to determine if their child had Tay-Sachs disease. So Ilana asks, what do you do with the embryos that are not healthy? We're going to put that one on. We're going to suspend those embryos in frozen limbo for now until next week, where we'll talk about. We'll keep them in the lab until next week, where we'll find out what happens to these embryos. So then the couple asks, Jacob and Rachel, he turns to themselves and they say, "Listen, you're already doing in vitro fertilization. You're going to have a bunch of embryos in the laboratory. You're going to be testing them anyway. You're going to test for Tay-Sachs. We already have a boy. Doctors, why don't you get us a girl this time so we can fulfill the mitzvah peru? And we can name the girl Ilana, either with an I or with an E, whatever you prefer." So this is another fascinating issue, and that's the use of this technology for gender selection, or sex selection, to determine the sex of a child. When this technology first started to be used about a decade or so ago, there was tremendous aversion to this technology. Now, almost all of the reproductive technology associations internationally accept the gender selection or so-called family balancing as something which is ethically permitted. The question is, what does halacha have to say about gender selection? What about the blue-eyed, blonde hair? This, of course, is not a joke. This is precisely where this technology is heading, the use of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to select out for other things. And here I'll make a brief tangent, and this, here again, I apologize. I don't think we're going to get into this extensively. But there is another fascinating area of application which is challenging the ethicists and hasn't yet reached the halachic journals, and will be restricted to our journal of the likes of which we're going to talk about next week, the Journal of Anticipatory Medical Halacha. There are couples that are specifically doing pre-implantation genetic diagnosis not to select out the diseases, but to select in diseases. So what do I mean by that? There are couples that are deaf, where both the husband and wife are deaf, and they want to have children that are likewise deaf. They don't want to raise a child that's not deaf. They believe that deafness is not a debility. They believe that deafness is a way of life. And they would rather have, it's easier for them and socially more comfortable for them to have a child who's deaf like them. So they're approaching the reproductive specialists and saying, perform pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Make sure my child has the same genetic defect that I do. I shouldn't say genetic defect. Say the same genetic makeup that I do. Another example where this is occurring is when there are couples that are dwarfs with short stature. And the way the genetics of dwarfism works, it's possible for them to produce children that are dwarfs. It's also possible for them to produce children that are short. So Rabbi Kelman's point is an interesting point. Not only Bottle of Dyson, but our rubric, our mantra is Rapo Yurape. We are performing these procedures for the sake of healing individuals. We're not performing these procedures for the sake of giving them diseases. Now, with deafness, there are other ramifications, maybe less so with dwarfism. You're creating a child that might not be able to observe many of the mitzvahs of the Torah. You're intentionally creating a child that may not be able to observe. Now, obviously, if someone is born with deafness, Baruch Hashem, there are many, many ways to circumvent that. And actually, I gave a lecture about 2-3 weeks ago, which had an interpreter throughout the course of the lecture. And there must have been about 15 or 20 people from the Jewish deaf community. This was in Rochester, New York, and it was a wonderful experience. But to specifically select out to create the child with that particular debility, I think it justify halachically. Right, so here the question is, and this is where society, and as Rabbi Kelman points out, this is where society is pushing norms. How you define normalcy? Does halacha have an objective definition of normalcy, or does society determine what normalcy is? And that applies to medical conditions, that applies to sexual orientation, it applies to a lot of different things. So clearly halacha has norms in many aspects. There may be some areas which are subject to interpretation, but clearly some which are not subject to interpretation. So let's return to our case here of the propriety of performing gender selection. Now, interestingly, there may be halakhic reasons that are not relevant to the general non-Jewish community for people to perform gender selection as Jews. So there was an article which appeared in the Journal of Assisted Reproductive Genetics, when you just have the title in the third page of your handout in the upper left-hand corner, addressing the idiosyncratic needs of Orthodox Jewish couples requesting sex selection by pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So, and this article discusses two fascinating cases, which are truly idiosyncratic to the Jewish, to the Orthodox Jewish community. And one is the following case. There was a couple where the husband was a Kohen, actually still is a Kohen, and they got permission. As it turns out, they suffered from infertility. They underwent a workup for infertility, and it turns out that the husband suffered from a rare medical condition called azoospermia, where he had no reproductive seed whatsoever. Today, by the way, even if someone has just a few, literally, a handful of reproductive seed, it is possible to isolate those and to perform a procedure called the ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, where you can take one single sperm and inject that into an egg. It's unbelievable technology. And for men that are incapable of emitting that seed naturally, they can do a testicular biopsy and literally search the entire testicle to find one or two sperm out of normally millions that would be emitted, and use those to achieve conception. As we mentioned, there is a fertile, if you will, discussion in the field of infertility and halacha. Testicular biopsy has many halachic issues related to serus, about the propriety of performing testicular biopsy, not so much our issue today. But this gentleman had suffered from azoospermia, no sperm whatsoever, and he got a psak, and not everybody would agree to this psak, for them to use donor sperm. And there is a machlokes, whether it's better to use non-Jewish donor sperm or Jewish donor sperm. Again, Rav Moshe weighed in on this in the major halachic debate of the 60s and 70s. But he got permission to have donor sperm, and he said, he asked a follow-up question. He said, you know, this child is not going to be halachically related to me, because I'm a Kohen, this child's not a Kohen. So when this child gets up to get an Aliyah, he's not going to have the first Aliyah. He's not going to be able to dukhan on Yontif. I'd rather this child be a girl, because it's more socially acceptable. And everyone would see that this man was pregnant with a child. Nobody would know that this child wasn't his child. So it would be very socially awkward, even if you pay the rabbi $1 million. Right, that's the joke. You know, my father was a Kohen, my grandfather was a Kohen. Even if you pay him $1 million. So he asked if the child could be a girl. And that was a halachic, idiosyncratic reason why a Jew would request gender selection. And there was another very interesting case where a man so the answer to that was, in this particular case, and again, not to generalize, we'll actually get the answer in a moment. We talk about the parameters of undergoing gender selection. The second idiosyncratic reason, there was a man who got a psak that he could have also, he could have donor insemination because he suffered from the same condition, but he wasn't a Kohen. But the rabbi who gave him the psak stipulated that it would be preferable if the child were a male child, because of the concern of yichud, because of the concern that this man would not be legally related to a daughter that he would have, because he is not the halachic father. So since he is not the halachic father, similar to adoption, there are concerns about yichud, concerns about them being in the same room together. Now, Rabbi Kellen writes that is a huge chumrah, and there are obviously many people who are permissive, especially in the case of adoption, especially in adoption at early age. But nonetheless, this rabbi was one of those machmirim, and he preferred that that the child indeed be a male child as opposed to a female child. Obviously, idiosyncratic to the very orthodox Jewish community. So, are these types of things permitted? Is gender selection permitted at all in the eyes of Jewish law? Is it not? Now, interestingly, there are many discussions in the Talmud that talk about ways to achieve pregnancy or conception of a particular gender. So positions during marital relations, other skulos, tzedakah, other forms of things that one could do to achieve conception of a particular gender. So since the Talmud suggests these things, now that we have the medical technology to be able to determine gender, would it be appropriate in the eyes of halacha to indeed avail ourselves? So the problem here is similar to the problem with general assisted reproduction, and that's the harvesting of the male reproductive seed in order to achieve this objective. Now, gender selection can be achieved in a number of different ways. From the medical perspective, gender selection can be done through sperm sorting. So, for example, a man could literally send a sample of reproductive seed to a laboratory. They would be able to separate it into two containers, an X container and a Y container. They'd send it back in the mail. You can use whichever one you want. And you could use those for artificial insemination. You could inject that reproductive seed directly into the reproductive tract of the wife, and you could produce a child of that particular gender. It is not as effective and accurate scientifically as other methods, and the detractors of this method say that the likelihood of achieving one gender over another is about 50-50. So obviously not as good as one would hope. But with pre-implantation genetic diagnosis in the hands of a good laboratory, the odds are close to 100% that you'd be able to determine that the embryo you are implanting is of one gender or another gender, because you're testing the fertilized embryo, whether it's an XX female or an XY male. So if you look at the upper right-hand corner of your handout, you'll see an article or an excerpt from an article which appeared in the journal Asia. It was written by Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Halpern, who's the editor of this journal Asia. And he writes in, we'll skip the letter Gimel, which is the second Hebrew paragraph. And he says, Legabe hafradat zera, regarding sperm sorting, hapostim osrim asatalich imhu noed aferat librirat hanin. So, if the sole purpose of performing this procedure is just for gender selection, you know, you had three boys and you want to have a girl, the poskim categorically forbid this. However, interestingly enough, and this will skip to the very last paragraph above, legabe zugot she'ovrim mimela PGD, igual indikatsia rifuit, regarding couples who are undergoing pre-implantation genetic diagnosis for other reasons, similar to our couple Jacob and Rachel, for a medical indication, ein minya l'ha'adif min misuyam. There is no reason not to select out one gender or another gender. So, interestingly, there are couples who are undergoing pre-implantation genetic diagnosis for genetic conditions, not purely for gender selection. They might be allowed, according to a number of poskim, to avail themselves of this technology and be able to select out one gender over another. There is one posek in Eretz Yisrael, one Sephardi posek, I believe it's from Mordechai Eliyahu, if I recall correctly, who says that if a couple has had, and I don't want to misquote, it's either five or six of one gender, and they don't suffer from any genetic conditions, they are allowed to avail themselves of this technology to choose the gender of the other kind. But one cannot say, you know, I have one girl, let me fulfill the mitzvah of Puravu and have a boy. One can't say, I just got married, I want to fulfill the mitzvah of a Bechor and Pidyon HaBen, so let's do gender selection so my first child will be a Bechor. That those are out of the question. But this couple, Jacob and Rachel, who are undergoing preimplantation genetic diagnosis to select out a child for medical indication for TAPEC, might indeed be able to select a female child as per their request, so they could fulfill the mitzvah of Peruvu. So they indeed do this, and they have a child, a healthy female child, a Baruch Hashem, not afflicted with disease Tay-Sachs, based on this, the application of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And everything is going along fine, until a few years later when Rachel gets a phone call from her mother. And her mother says to her, you know, Rachel, don't worry, everything is okay. I want you to know that I went to the doctor. The doctor found out that I have breast cancer. The doctor caught it very early. We don't need to do radical surgery, and the doctor thinks there's a very high likelihood of cure. So Rachel is an educated young woman. She reads the New York Times, and she reads the internet blogs, and she knows that there is a particular association with genetic forms of breast cancer and Jews. So she says to her mother, so listen, Mom, this may be a genetic form of breast cancer. If you have a genetic form of breast cancer, I may have a susceptibility to this. Why don't you ask the doctor to test you to see if you have this particular gene? And there are these two genes that are now known to be associated with both breast cancer and ovarian cancer in the Jewish community. Those genes are called BRCA1, short for BR breast CA cancer 1, and BRCA2. And those genes are associated with both breast cancer and ovarian cancer. So the mother turns to Rachel and says, listen, I have to deal, she's an older woman, I've had enough of my life, I've already got the cancer, I don't have to worry about this, I have no desire to test for this. Leave me alone. So interesting how lovely questions. Rachel, who's now a young woman, is Baruch Hashem healthy, does she have an obligation to test herself for this condition, or does she not? And the answer to that lies in a scientific understanding. Now, we are gaining much more knowledge of this gene every day, every month, every year, what this gene means, and what are the ramifications of testing positive for this gene, and what can be done for this gene. A couple of very important facts, just to dispel some myths. The majority of breast cancer is not associated with genes, is not transmitted genetically from generation to generation. It is spontaneous. It occurs in the individual with an aberration of their genes when they are an adult, and it is not genetic. A small percentage of breast cancer is indeed genetic and is passed down from generation to generation. Those cancers generally afflict people at a much younger age, can often afflict multiple members of the family. So there are certain medical history taking which it would impact on the likelihood of this being a genetic form of the disease and whether or not Rachel should indeed test herself or not test herself. So we have to ask from a halachic perspective, there's an obligation of the rapo yirapé and there's an obligation of preventative medicine. Since Rachel knows that her mother has breast cancer, should she now test herself for this gene? And other questions to consider. If she tests herself for this gene, and she is found to be positive, what does she now do with that information? And that takes on a number of different aspects. Aspect number one, should she now undergo, for example, more frequent mammograms? Should she start taking chemotherapy for the prevention of breast cancer, like tamoxifen, which is a medicine one could take every day? Should she do something so radical as to undergo bilateral mastectomy? Should she have surgical removal of both breasts because perhaps there's a likelihood that she might develop the disease? The answer to these questions is by no means simple, and these require consultation both with genetic specialists and with scientists at the particular time that if one found to be positive. The statistics about the likelihood of developing the cancer, at what age, and are all evolving, and are all being accumulated as we are sitting here in our discussion this evening. So this woman, Rachel, indeed decides to be tested, and she is found to be positive. She is found to be positive for this breast cancer gene. So not only does she have to discuss with the rabbi whether she should undergo some radical procedure, whether she's prohibited from undergoing the procedure or even obligated to undergo the procedure, she has another new dilemma. She has a young daughter at home. What should she tell to her daughter? Does she have an obligation to tell her daughter that she may be positive for this breast cancer gene because her mother has the gene? And if she tells her daughter, at what age should she tell her daughter? And if she tells this daughter, and this daughter is now of marriageable age, does this daughter now have an obligation to tell a potential spouse that she has this cancer, this breast cancer gene? So should she say, "Hi, my name is Leah, and I am BRCA1 positive. Would you like to go out for a cup of coffee?" Does she have to tell her potential spouse up front? Does she have to tell her potential spouse ever? You can imagine a scenario. There's many of these websites. SawYouAtSinai.com, JDate.com, Frumster.com, OnlySimchas.com. They have profiles of all these single individuals. You can imagine they not only have a picture, they have some fancy software where you plug in your entire genetic makeup, and you plug in the person you want to date, and they'll show, you know, both chromosomes line up, and then maybe the chromosomes will meld into each other, and they'll see if you're a genetic match or if you're not a genetic match. I mean, it sounds crazy, but that scenario is not so far from possibility. So are you obligated to that information? So by Kelman writes, the insurance companies would want to know this, and I actually have here. You're not going to read it inside. It's getting towards the end of our lecture, and we'll close in another moment or two. But you have here on the bottom of page 3 the great concern about the insurance companies getting hold of this information, you know, banning genetic discrimination. And the Senate passed a law in 2005, which would significantly limit, if not entirely prevent, insurance companies from using this information to genetically discriminate. And the Hadassah women and other Jewish organizations are leading the lobbies in Washington to try and preclude discrimination based on genetic information. But just to close, in terms of exposure of this, or disclosure, rather, of this information to a potential spouse, we turn to the last page of our handout. And here we have guidelines from the great Chofetz Chaim, the author of the classic work on Lashon Hara, where he discusses which types of information have to be divulged from one spouse to a potential spouse. So in that context, it not only, by the way, can be disclosed, must be disclosed, information which one must disclose to a potential spouse, just like one must disclose information to a potential business partner. So if one, God forbid, has an existing disease, such as a cancer that they are being treated for, that's the kind of thing that someone should disclose to a potential spouse. But that person might indeed continue with the marriage, and that would be absolutely wonderful. But it's the kind of information which the individual should know before they proceed into such an engagement and such an arrangement. So the Chofetz Chaim says that in order to meet the criteria for required transmission or required disclosure, he writes three main criteria. One should be certain of the diagnosis, and this relates to our BRCA1, which we'll say in a moment. One should not exaggerate the nature of the disease. So, for example, if a physician knows that a patient he's treating has cancer, and he's an oncologist, and that person is about to be married, and he refuses to disclose that to his future wife, the oncologist, at least in the eyes of halacha, might indeed be obligated himself to go tell that woman of the medical condition of that individual. But he must be certain of the diagnosis. He shouldn't do it in an exaggerated form. And important, one's intentions of disclosure should be purely for the benefit of the potential spouse and their family, and not in order to cause harm to the affected person. So the question is, does BRCA1 meet this criteria or not? And the answer is absolutely not. BRCA1 is not an existing disease. It's a predisposition. This individual might never develop cancer. They might develop cancer at age 60 after the husband may have passed from something else. And if they develop the condition because they're testing more frequently to determine when they have it, they might catch it at a stage where it's imminently treatable and curable. But of course, if the individual wants to disclose that information to a potential spouse, and that may indeed be not an improper thing to do, then obviously it would be appropriate to do. And obviously establishing a relationship with trust at the beginning is essential ingredient for the success of any relationship. But to me, it doesn't meet the halakhic threshold of a requirement to divulge, as would be the case with other existing diseases. So in conclusion, this young family, this young couple of Jacob and Rachel, who never heard of genetic testing a number of years ago, have now had the opportunity to be exposed in full force to many aspects of genetics, including original testing with Doria Chardon and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis and genes which indicate a predisposition for cancer. This is only, not to scare you all, this is only going to get more complex in the future. More genes are going to be described for predisposition. The tests will be offered more routinely. It may be possible to determine, even in prenatal conditions, without performing amniocentesis, it may be able to be performed by simple blood tests to be able to determine whether a fetus is afflicted with diseases. And all these responses about the permissibility of abortion, especially the responsum of the Tzitz Eliezer, will have to be revisited in light of this new understanding of genetics and applied to many, many new and exciting genetic conditions. So I look forward next week in Mirat Hashem when we will we've covered the past and we've covered some aspects of the present. Next week when I introduce you to the Journal of Anticipatory Medical Halacha, we will talk about some absolutely fascinating, cutting-edge scientific research, which is going to pose fascinating halachic issues for the rabbis of future generations. Good night, everybody. And if anyone has any questions, either audio or written questions, I'd be happy to entertain them. You're very welcome, Ilana. Ilana, put it up. Have a good night, Aubrey.
Okay, thanks. Any questions, anybody? You can speak up, use the speaker part of your mic now if you'd like. Otherwise, we can see you next week. Wish you a good Shabbos. Do you have a question, I think?
If a girl knows that she can have a child, does she have to make that known to a shadchan or a shadchanit? And if so, what's the ramifications there? Does the shadchan shadchanit have to tell the potential shidduch?
Question. In answer to that, there's no question that the woman herself has to divulge that information to her potential spouse. Whether the information should be given to the shadchan or shadchanit to divulge, that's sort of a juggling act about who is better to have that information. And there is a debate about when that information should be disclosed. Should you disclose it up front in the initial date? Should you disclose it after you've had a few dates? And the reason why this issue has taken on a different aspect in our generation is because there are many ways to circumvent infertility today. So if a woman, for example, let's say she even had a hysterectomy, she had her uterus removed, or she had no uterus, she had congenital absence of the uterus, which the Tzitz Eliezer, by the way, says that clearly a woman has an absolute halakhic obligation to divulge that information to a potential spouse, they can perform in vitro fertilization. They could take her eggs and his sperm and fertilize it in a laboratory, and undergo in vitro fertilization and hire a surrogate mother to bear a child for them. So assisted reproduction has necessitated a change in a number of areas of Jewish law. Even, by the way, the laws of divorce. After 10 years of infertility, a man or woman is justified in asking of a get from the other partner. And in our day and age, there are halakhic questions about if one of the partners says, listen, you know, we can't conceive naturally, and it's been 10 years, but what about undergoing in vitro fertilization? I agree to undergo in vitro fertilization. Is that sufficient enough to obviate the need for them to divorce? Divorce, by the way, today is not halakhically obligated to do. It's just if one partner, you know, would want to do it on the books, say such a law exists. So in answer to your question, one is indeed clearly halakhically obligated to divulge that information. I'm not sure if it's best to give that information to the shadchan, or if it's better that it come from the individual herself. And also exploration of other possibilities of achieving a successful conception, even with a lot of varying medical conditions, could be explored as a way of obviating the infertility.
So how far do we go in testing for that? In other words, obviously a woman would not want to know she can't have kids. In other words, sometimes it's better not to find out. So how far can we demand people find out these type of things?
I don't have any truth to this rumor whatsoever, but I heard that in some Sparta communities that they required a sample of reproductive seed from a potential man that would marry any of their daughters to determine their fertility. There is clearly, absolutely no halakhic obligation to determine somebody's fertility prior to marriage. If it so happens that, as Hashgacha would have it, the couple suffers from infertility, then that's obviously there's some Hashgacha for that, and they should be treated accordingly. It doesn't mean that every woman should undergo an ultrasound, every man should have a semen analysis prior to marriage. However, their interesting shaila is if someone has a potential predisposition to infertility. So, for example, you know, in a male condition, some man could have had a testicular problem as a child. Is that something which should be tested for prior to marriage? That already is a different child. If they had a varicocele, which is an anatomical variant which might cause infertility. There may be halakhic permissibility to undergo they should not do it.
Doctor, I know you mentioned in the terms of the girl who she has to make it known to that she can't have a child. And it's now you just mentioned with the guy. If, let's say he doesn't have, let's say he's unable to have a child. Obviously, does he have to make that known to the Shadchan Shadchani? And on a second question, my understanding of the permissibility of a man is supposed to marry a woman in order to have a child. Well, if he goes in, if he knows that the woman that he wants to marry is unable to have a child, completely barren, is one of the permissibilities to allow this marriage for them to adopt, i.e., if they can adopt, it would be an allowance for them to get married?
So in answer to question one, the answer is the same is true for the man and the woman. The man has just as much, although the man has the obligation of, technically, the man has the obligation of puravu, and the woman, technically, according to the letter of the law, doesn't have the obligation of puravu. But nonetheless, it is essential that the man divulge this information to any potential spouse if he is known to suffer from infertility. With respect to your other question, according to the letter of the law, technically a man shouldn't marry a woman who's known to suffer from infertility. Having said that, there are many, many cases, and this is obviously on a case-by-case basis, many, many men who have received the complete permission from rabbinic authorities to marry women that they know suffer from infertility and are unable to bear children, and they can adopt children or they can undergo other forms of assisted reproduction to possibly even theoretically have children of their own. But that's clearly been the practice within the Jewish community and continues to be the practice.
All right, Eddie, we'll let you have a good Shabbos as well, and say, I'm your son.
Good Shabbos, everybody. Mr. Shem, we'll see you next week as we peer into the future.